Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugapul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Noonuckle, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, what a big weekend it was. Plenty of rain, wasn't it? Plenty of rain. And the Clancestry event opened up on Friday night. The blue sky came out. Well, the rain stopped. Might have been still some clouds, but the rain stopped. Right on cue, about half an hour before the opening of Clancestry. Now, Clancestry was the big arts festival, cultural festival, down at QPAC, at Queensland Performing Arts Centre. And it was just amazing. No rain. It was a dry opening, and it was just fantastic. Performances there by Archie Roach and Troy Cassidaly, Lou Bennett, the Chookie Dancers, the ACPA students, that's the Aboriginal Centre for Performing Arts here in Brisbane, and two different groups of Torres Strait Island dancers. It was an amazing night. Fantastic. They had a dance ground set up out in the open there on the riverbank, between QPAC and the riverbank. It was just fantastic. Amazing. And the Queensland Minister for the Arts, I think it's Ian Walker, was the man, the official there that got up and made a presentation. It was a bit of a downer comment from him, poor old fella. He says, commenting on a young four-year-old Torres Strait Islander dancer, an amazing young dancer. He looked like he was four or five max. And the minister says, well, fortunate it is for you, young fella, to be there dancing in front of the governor. Something you would have seen in the 1800s, actually. Back in the 1800s, you would have seen that in the movies or something. There's some comment. How lucky you are, young man. You've been able to dance in front of the queen. But this one was in front of the governor, was there. But, anyway. But this young fellow was just amazing, that young dancer, and he was well worth commenting on. He's quite impressive. The weekend, rained all weekend, but performances continued on anyway. They went inside. They were put on inside. It was fantastic. The closing ceremony last night was just probably, you know, it's probably the first time since colonisation, first time since the invasion, for Brisbane to be able to see 150 to 200 dancers, including Torres Strait Islander dance groups. Dancers from all around the country were there. It was from all around southeast Queensland way, and Gomeroi dancers of northwest New South Wales. But they were amazing. It was a choreographed opening, and it was just fantastic. Fantastic. So it was good. Clancestry went off like it should have, in spite of the weather. Today's show. Am I black enough for you? It's Clancestry. It's the recording of Clancestry's Thursday night's conversation with Anita Heiss, who is an author, First Nations author, Chelsea Bond, the First Nations academic, Kevin O'Brien, architect, First Nations man, Megan Cope, an artist, First Nations woman. Have a listen to them.
Good evening, everyone, and it's wonderful to be here on the ancient lands of our custodians of the Brisbane region. I welcome you all. So we're going to have a great discussion. This is something that, for Clancestry, is wonderful to have a platform where we're able to discuss some of the many issues we as Aboriginal people discuss in our own communities. But we often don't get the platform to hear the varying opinions of issues that affect us on a daily basis. So we will allow some time later in the evening for questions. But first, I'd like to welcome our panel, and I'll introduce from my right, of course, we'll go to the male, the only male on our panel. So Mr. Kevin O'Brien, he's an architect. You're only born in 1972. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're a baby, darling. Mm-hmm. That was my first year of high school. Anyway, he finally, when he grew up, graduated from the University of Queensland in 95, has a Bachelor of Architecture, and in 2006, he graduated with a Master's of Philosophy. In 2007, Kevin established Kevin O'Brien Architects in Brisbane, and between 2009 to 2011, he designed and built the Archibald Street House with Susan Ellison. The house was built around the Indigenous and European traditions of its inhabitants. Really interesting. And in 2013, he was appointed Professor of Design, School of Design, Creative Faculty, Queensland University. Fantastic. Amazing. Beside Kevin is a wonderful Mulunjali woman, Dr. Chelsea Bond, who's currently employed as a senior lecturer with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies Unit at the University of Queensland. Chelsea has worked as an Aboriginal health worker and researcher in urban and rural communities for many, 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 many years. She's also a mother. But as an Aboriginal woman, Chelsea has a strong and personal and professional interest in Aboriginal identity. In fact, her PhD research critically examined the construction of Aboriginality within the public health practice. On my left, the gorgeous Dr. Anita Heiss. Now, we know her. I'm sure many of you know her. She's an author of fiction, non-fiction, historical fiction and commercial women's fiction, also a bit of poetry, social commentary and travel articles. That's a bit of a junket, isn't it?
A little bit.
Gosh, can I do some of those travel ones
sure.
with you? Yeah. But she's also the author of some best-selling novels, Not Meeting Mr. Right and Avoiding Mr. Right. Are you still single?
Tonight,
you got a bloke,
I am. Might not be tomorrow.
She might not be tomorrow. There's drinks in the foyer afterwards. And Anita has won 4 Deadly Awards for Outstanding Achievement in Literature. And her most recent book is, this is the big plug, Am I Black Enough for You? So that's Miss Anita Heiss, or Dr. Anita Heiss, I should say. And beside Anita, probably our youngest member of the panel, Megan Cope. And Megan works in the visual arts practice, investigates issues relating to identity, the environment and mapping practices. She's from the Quandamooka region. And through her art, she explores decolonising mythologies, which have become a primary concern in many of her video works along with her paintings. So welcome, panel. Let's get stuck into it. I'm going to start with Anita first. And Anita, what I'd like to ask you is, you know, often when you meet a black fella, it's like, oh, g'day, sis, how you going, brother? Who's your mob, right? But we talk about country, and country defines many, many things, as does community. What's your country?
My country is Wiradjuri country, central New South Wales. My mobs, we often talk about country, but we talk about also in modern sense, so what the mission from where you're from and the Anglo or the name. So I'm a Williams from Arambi and from Brungle Mission, and Griffith, Cowra, Tumut, Wiradjuri countries, central New South Wales, one of the largest nations in New South Wales. And, you know, we're talking about Mudgee, Bathurst, Dubbo, Condo and places like that. But I was born in Gadigal country, and most of you all know that as the city of Sydney. And I've spent most of my life growing up on Darawal land, which is La Perouse, strategically placed between Long Bay Jail, Malabar Sewerage Works and Orica Industrial Estate. And so I feel like I have a connection to those three places because I have a birthright, I guess, in Sydney, in Gadigal country. And I consider myself a manager of country because I'm not from there, but I have a responsibility to care for country. And I would say I feel like I'm a part of those three communities because, you know, one of the things when we talk about who's your mob, where you're from, it's about what community do you belong to. And I think lots of people often think also that community is about only Aboriginal people have a sense of community, but I'm also a member of a writer's community and a black women writer's community. So having said all that, I'm really excited to be here in Murray country and on the traditional lands of the local mobs on both sides of the river. And because I've spent a lot of time here, so I feel like I'm part of a community here as well.
Well, Chelsea, you're, of course, living in Inala. Tell us about Mulunjali land and what country means to you.
Okay, so I in terms of my identity, I have to declare that Bond is my married name. And that indicates my husband's mob. I'm originally a Wadigo, and that acknowledges my South Sea Islander ancestry as well. I'm Mananjali through my nana, who was through the Williams family at Beaudesert. But I was born and raised in Brisbane and lived most of my life in Yuggera country. My husband's an Anala boy, and he took me there many years ago. And it's the place that we decided to raise our family because it provided a sense of cultural safety and security in identity that other suburbs couldn't offer us in Brisbane. And so for us, there's a strong sense of attachment and identity with a community like Anala.
And, of course, in Anala, it is a very large Aboriginal community, as we know, but it has, I guess, some of that cultural obligation you have to community. You've really taken that to heart, particularly with some of the volunteering work you're actually doing in that community, which perhaps if you were living back on a mission day, you would have been doing that on country.
I think community involvement, community participation is at the core of our identity, and it really contrasts with public discourses around Aboriginal people and communities as being passive and welfare dependent. For many of us, our sense of identity is bound up in our involvement in our community, in our activism. So it's not a choice, it's what we just do and what we have to do. And I've done research with communities where I ask aunties if they volunteer. Black fellas don't volunteer. We don't talk about it like that, it's just what we do. So that sense of activism and involvement, it is part of how I see my identity.
And for you, Kevin, of course, your heritage back in the Torres Straits, how do you regard what country you come from and your community?
Yeah, it's a tricky question, but I guess because of Mum's family from the mission there on Hammond Island, that's the place I never grew up but I always call home. And through Mum's family, people, the Kurrig people there and the Miriam people, through my grandmother out in the east. And I get up there every year to see family and do all that sort of stuff. So what I've been trying to do, I guess, with this new role with QUT is take students of architecture and landscape architecture to this place to understand country as not as this cultural thing, but as the origin of how you might define space, which is what we have to do as architects, articulate space. So country for me is it's a part of a bigger idea that I've called Finding Country, and it's a thing I'll talk about later that I took to Venice, and it generates all the sort of central ideas of how we approach architecture, or should, in this country.
And our youngest member of the panel, Megan, I keep saying that, don't I? So you're much more local, of course, Stradbroke Island we've all heard about, and there's been quite a lot of historical events occurring in Stradie, but indeed with the native title more recently. So what would you regard as your country?
Well, actually, so I grew up... I didn't grow up on country. I grew up in Tasmania. My father moved away from Queensland in the 80s during the Bjelke-Petersen regime because it just wasn't a very healthy place to be in the 80s. So we grew up down there. But always had a very... He always told me about Stradbroke Island, and I used to go for holidays, to my nana's, and we'd go swimming all the time. And I felt like that place knew who I was, even though I didn't know that place very well. You know, when I came back to Queensland in my late teens, everybody knew who I was and where I was from and my country. So I've been very fortunate to have that connection to my country. We're very lucky on Stradbroke Island that we have made history in the way that we've, we got our native title determinations a couple of years ago, which is like the first in a metropolitan area. It was a big, long fight, but it's a real achievement, and
And of course your dad left Queensland, left Joe, went to Tasmania and decided to hang around with Jimmy Everett and Michael Mansell.
So you
sort of grew up in a bit of hearing a lot of other things. And
yes.
I just want to, just because you've mentioned Tasmania, a number of years ago, of course, there was the big issue in Tasmania where more and more people were discovering that they have had in their family histories some Aboriginal identity as such. And so I think it was 94, correct me, I could be wrong, but the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre were finding it quite difficult because as one of the smaller groups of Aboriginal people in Australia, they only were getting so much funding for various housing services, et cetera, et cetera. And so they established a thing where if you were Aboriginal, you had to go by a certain date in 94 to the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre and sign for your family being Aboriginal. And if you didn't do it then, their question to you was, well, why are you coming now? Because you didn't register your family in 94. And it's quite interesting how other communities are now looking at that particular model. But just to get onto that, the three-point plan, there's a Commonwealth definition to be Aboriginal. Aboriginal descent or Torres Strait Islander, you identify as an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander and your community recognises you. Does that fit into your lives with that sort of identity? Don't be frightened to jump in. Do you like the three-point plan?
I'm troubled by the fact that our conversations focus on Aboriginality as a piece of paper and it stops us from talking about identity as lived. And I think there's a fair degree of suspicion in the mainstream community about why would you claim an Aboriginal identity? Because for many non-Indigenous Australians, there couldn't possibly be of anything of value to it except for some financial gain. So there's this real suspicion of Indigenous people. For those of us who identify, we know that there's tremendous value in claiming our identity that has nothing to do with a low-interest loan on a house. It is our sense of humour, it's our sense of connectedness, it's about belonging, it's about how we give meaning to our world, it's about our sense of family. There's a whole lot of other stuff that our identity means. And sometimes by focusing on this part of the conversation, we forget to talk about identity as lived every day in this country.
I don't sit around with my family and friends and talk about identity. You know, I have these conversations when I get invited to go to festivals or on television or whatever to have the conversation. We don't sit around talking about how to define what it means to be black. No. You know, we do all the bitchy stuff like everybody else does, or, you know, whatever. But so that's one thing. I think the conversation is in the public domain now because non-Indigenous people have made it a public issue. So I'm really pleased that we're actually controlling this conversation instead of actually reacting to what goes on. And having had to do that for the last few years, you know, I can talk at nauseam about that. The other thing is a lot of people don't, a lot of our mob don't recognise that the form exists. In recent times, we need to have those sort of safeguards because non-Indigenous people have ripped off the programs that have been set up to help redress the imbalance that exists for our mob across every part of society. So, for instance, you know, I publish books. I was already published with Magabala Books at the time that Leon Carman was a white male taxi driver who'd never met an Aboriginal woman before, impostered himself as Wandakul Machi and wrote a book, won prizes and so forth.
Yes.
Now, I understand that organisations need to have in place mechanisms. We're punished by it. We're punished. It is a dog tag sort of thing, but we are now punished because of the behaviour, the bad behaviour of non-Indigenous people. And I do want to safeguard programs and strategies that are being developed so that our people have access and equity in terms of education and employment and housing and health and so forth.
I might mention that because one of the things, you know, whether you go for a housing loan, but indeed with arts, if you go for some arts funding, of course, you often with some processes, you have to provide a confirmation of Aboriginality, which means you go to the local land council of the country you're from, they sign to say, yes, you are a member of this community and you have your confirmation. And there's been quite a lot of discussion, particularly across the arts sector, about this. And at times, and I, again, do understand the process, but at times it's been quite ludicrous, you know, getting turned down or questioned because you're doing a project with someone like Jakapura Manyaran from Northeast Arnhem Land, who clearly is Aboriginal, but hasn't got a confirmation of Aboriginality. Now, Megan, you faced an issue with this.
Well, recently, I mean, I've always just been Aboriginal and I've always made art, but, you know, I'm thinking I've got bigger ideas now and so, you know, you need a bit more money. So recently I decided to apply for a grant for the first time and I thought, OK, I'm going to apply through the Australia Council, through the Indigenous funding body, not just because it's there, but because the work that I make is about our issues. And so I like to think that I'm adding to this discourse, and so that, you know, this discourse should be funded through that stream as well. So I get through the paperwork and filling out the form, and I thought, oh, I've got to get my certificate of Aboriginality. Oh, okay, no worries. I ring up Minjirabum Morgan Elders and I speak to my auntie there, and she said, oh, yeah, no worries, bub, we'll email it through. And I said, oh, yeah, what I've got to do? Oh, you've got to go to a JP and then you send it back and then we'll go through a meeting. And I was like, oh, cool, okay, no worries. And then before I hung up, I was like, oh, do you reckon I'll get it? And, like, and she laughed and said, yeah, bub, like, don't be silly. We all know who you are. But I thought that was, like, once we hung up, I kind of, like, thought about what the hell just happened. Mm-hmm. And, like, I actually had an overwhelming sense of self-doubt for the first time. Like, I'm 30 years old. I've always been this way. But going through that system really kind of, I don't know, like, I can't believe that sort of happened. I thought it was really strange.
Can I just say on top of that, because I've sat on boards of community organisations where we have the process where people, and nobody, I speak for myself, but I'm fairly sure that nobody goes through that as part of that signing and the organisational seal. When we think about it, feels comfortable doing that, but we understand it's something that collectively, look, there were 63 different pieces of legislation in history defining who we are. This one was adopted in, was it 84 or 94 or something like that? So this is something that we have collectively as a community, whatever, picked up and run with. Nobody feels comfortable doing that. I hate it when I don't sign off anything that if I don't know the person, I just say, look, I don't know that family. I don't know them. I can't be part of that process. And I think organisations, land councils, community orgs, whoever, who are conscious of what they're doing, and most are, do take it very, very seriously. Because
well, it's actually fraudulent. Yeah. If you feel you've got some Aboriginal heritage but you don't come from a community or you haven't identified as Aboriginal officially, and you sign a paper to get a grant, and then, we find out you're not Aboriginal, it's actually a criminal offence. So I think a lot of people put this in process to protect not only themselves but their organisations as well.
I mean, I'm the last person that wants to be the identity police. And so it's quite difficult when people are put in that situation. But I can see both sides of it. And I'm just saying that it's not easy for the other people either, you know, that have to make the decision. And when most of us are lucky that we know. I can go back to Cowra or Wagga or wherever and it's all okay. For some people who don't know their family and can't go to their local land council, it's problematic.
That's a big issue in the arts. But for you, Kevin, there's quite a few Aboriginal architects now. Do you face those issues when you're working on buildings or going into communities?
I do, yeah. We just hit the magic number of 10 graduates in the country. When I graduated in 95, there was over 100 Maori architects in New Zealand. So Australia's sort of dragging well, well, well behind. We've only had the one professorial position who's come from our background in any of the architecture schools in the country. So that's a pretty poor state of affairs, I think, because there's some great architects who also happen to be Aboriginal and Islander. So that's the first thing. But I guess going back to the question just before that about the,
the definition.
The definitions, like, they're quite clumsy. But I don't know what else we've got, because the other system is what the Canadians have, and they actually have, they're almost like driver's license, and they have expiry dates
on it.
So
they have C51. Wow. They talk about blood quantum in Canada.
Well, this is it.
You know, you can be, you've got one white parent, you're under a policy of C51, you lose status rights.
But for Aboriginal women in Canada, this is the most appalling. They see it as a form of genocide. So if an Aboriginal woman marries a white man, she no longer has status. But if a white woman marries an Aboriginal man, she has status. And status means you can go to the medical service and get free clinics and various other things. And they're having major discussions about status and non-status, because an Aboriginal woman who gives birth to a child is giving birth to an Aboriginal child. How does that make you feel as a mother if you were in that situation?
Extremely uncomfortable. I mean, I guess to add to the conversation, I'm also on a board which we have to consider
that issue. And we're very careful about the conversation we have with people if we cannot confirm it. And the conversation is about, we're not saying that you're not Aboriginal. We're just saying we don't have the capacity to be able to author, you know, to sign off on it. And there are three criteria. It's not enough just to be of descent. It is about identification. It is about community involvement. So there are times where we have to say to people, maybe you go back to the community that you identify with, that where you are known, or where somebody knows you, or knows your family, or knows your auntie, or where there's some connection there. And I think that community connectedness, I think that's an important criteria to have, that it's not just I suddenly discovered I've got an Aboriginal great-great-grandparent. Identity is lived.
You know, it's interesting. Yes. There was an article not long ago on that very issue. A gentleman who was clearly Aboriginal had been taken away and grown up in Melbourne with a white family. He had his own family and he wanted to get a confirmation. So he went to the local land council of the area he was living in, and of course they were faced with this situation going, we're really sorry, we don't know you. You need to go back to the community where you come from or the country you come from, because we don't legally feel we can sign this. And of course it hit the front pages going, and of course it was an urban organisation. Big discussions about the many people who are in that organisation that were regarded as fair-skinned. And but the way it was reported made out that we were denying this man his Aboriginality, which was not we, but they. But the reality was they were simply saying, you need to go where people know you. We don't have the right to sign this. So the issue of confirmation is a big one, but it brings in the whole thing of identity. And lately we're seeing discussions on who is an Aboriginal? How far back do you go? How many generations is it, you know, you've got a great-great-grandmother that happened to be Aboriginal? Or is it a lived life? And I'd love to hear your views on that, because that whole discussion in the community is changing, not only from whether you do have this ancestry to the point of where you're living and where your country is.
I totally subscribe to what you're saying, this idea about it being a lived thing, because those three questions are trying to quantify so they can take a picture and see what it looks like. But I think what we're all doing, the four of us, is we have this heritage, but we're applying it in our domains of expertise, and mine's in architecture and health and writing and art. And it's like, you know, when you try to look at the moon, you look beside it to see it. That's how I think we could probably, you know, start thinking about identity, just in a slightly different thing. It's a verb, not a noun. That's the conversation I have with my peers.
How do you introduce yourself when you meet people? Do you are you an architect? Are you Kevin first, or are you your language group person first? Or
the best way I can describe it, there was an old Taoiseach called Charles Haughey in Ireland, and he had the gift of the gab, and he turned up to all the different counties, and he'd start a speech by saying, it's great to be home. And he was what he needed to be in that context, in that conversation. He was also a nudist.
Was he nude at the time?
So it depends, because identities, you know, it, to me it's a daisy chain of things. So if I'm with a group of architects, I identify as an architect. My degree says I'm an architect. They tell me I'm an Indigenous one. If I'm at the football, I'm a Red supporter. If I'm, you know, at the school, I'm doing these other things, and, you know, so on and so forth. So it depends what the context is.
Okay. I mean, I think none of us here want to act as the moral compass what it means to be Indigenous, Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander. I'm really interested in whose agenda we're serving by policing identity. And so if you look throughout our history, the colonial imperative has been to deny our existence. So, you know, Terra Nullius and invasion was premised on the idea that we weren't even human. When it was discovered that we were human, we were a race without a future, so we were a dying race. So we were able to, you know, there was protection and segregation and rounding up of us Melbourne missions and reserves. When it was discovered that our population was growing in size, new theories had to emerge to explain away our existence in this country. And this whole idea that we are not really Aboriginal serves that agenda. And so I'm really reluctant to try and assert a position that Aboriginality has to equal this or that, or it can't be this or it can't be that, because we all have a different encounters with colonisation. We have different stories, different journeys, and I'm really interested in how we put forward our stories of identity as authentic just because they're our stories, rather than subscribing to colonialist imaginings of the noble savage or those kinds of ideas. And I think we have to question what we're doing when we are policing each other's identity, and whose interests are we serving?
And that whole policing has been going on very recently.
Absolutely. Like, there's so many things that... many of you would have watched the Mundine Gill fight recently. I didn't watch it. I was doing Twitter and watching the live feed that they had there. And I nearly felt ill with the stuff that I was reading from our mob about Gill. You know, my response the next day was this one or two lines saying, because somebody asked me in a public forum, I wonder what Anita Heiss thinks about this, and I just said, I think we're all just better. I don't want to be the identity police. I think people should focus on how they carry themselves out every day as individuals, and not be concerned about how other people identify themselves. One of the reasons I wrote product placement, Am I Black Enough for You, was to actually show that through everyday life and activity, whether it's working with the kids at LAPA or shopping at Tiffany's, my Aboriginality is part of every day. And as I said, it's not something I sit around and talk about or wake up thinking about, or, you know, I just get on and I get myself to work and I do my thing, and I know that the conversations I have and the invitations I get are often because I'm Indigenous, and that's because I can say the things that need to be said without knifing somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm 40 now and I cannot say what I read on Twitter. I wouldn't say now what I was watching 20-year-olds say on Twitter, because I could see in them the passion of youth that I had when I was young, and then with wisdom and age and hanging around with elders more, you learn if anyone's got the right to be cranky about a lot of things, it's our old people. And they're not the cranky ones that are saying all the stuff. Mm. It's our generation. We're cranky because we know how our old people were treated. You know, and I've just gone through that hideous court case because... And the reason I went in there, and I know we didn't want to talk about it, the reason I went in there is because I refuse to have Australian media tell me who I am. And I refuse to have them intimidate young Indigenous Australians by suggesting to them that if they live in the city, that if they go to a Catholic school, that if they have blue eyes or they're light skin, if they don't have substance abuse issues, if they're not on welfare, if they want to be an architect, then they can't be black. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had a civil rights movement in this country that's still going on that was about us having all those opportunities. And the minute we start to evolve and change out of that stereotype, you can't be black anymore. You must be coming white. And
it's that we have a new middle class.
Mm. And why shouldn't we? Everyone absolutely. I know works 70 hours a week. Mm. They work hard and they sit on boards and they do love jobs, volunteering. You know, why shouldn't
that's
we?
That's what you're saying.
I mean, as a mum...
The fear of there's this whole new middle class who are educated, bright, articulate, they've actually gone through the system, understand the system, are actually working in the system and have the capacity to change the system from an Aboriginal perspective.
Yep. I mean, as a mum, I find it really horrific, some of the stuff that's said about the possibilities of our existence as Aboriginal people, because I want my kids to do the best they can at school, do whatever they want. And I was always raised that my Aboriginality was never a barrier to me achieving. It was the thing that motivated me to be 10 times better than the person beside me, because we had to be. There's an African-American scholar, Williams, who talks about racial socialisation. And he says it's the task that black parents have in raising healthy black kids with a healthy sense of identity in a world that demonises that blackness. Mm. And for many Indigenous families and individuals, we are constantly negotiating having a healthy, strong sense of self in a world that sees it as problematic and uncertain and constantly questioning it.
Can I also say that, you know, when I was a little kid and Paul Keating was the Prime Minister of Australia, and you could turn the TV on a Saturday and Yothu Yindi is playing on the TV, you turn the radio on and Wurrumpi Band's on and it's mainstream and it was cool. There was no shame growing up as Aboriginal person. Like, and by the time I became a teenager and then Howard became Prime Minister and then all of these questions started coming around and I was also having an identity crisis, as all teenagers do, I was really confused about, you know, sort of what you were saying. Like, I thought, well, no, all of my... everyone in my family has a job. We all go to school. Like, these are just the things we do. We do these things that are different on the weekends, you know, but it's kind of normal too. Like, it's not that different. And I think that that really took us back, you know, a long way with the Howard years in terms... Because we're really on a good streak. Like, well,
we committed the murders.
There was no shame.
We took the children. Yeah. And then we got Johnny. Yeah. And on that note, let's have some questions.
While we're waiting, can I just talk about language, the language of Paul Keating's empowering, assuming responsibility to the, and then the shift in language that happened when we had the Howard era, and even who have we got now? Oh, Goodgerly Gardner, the Tony Abbott sort of situation. Yeah. Now, there's a whole. I hope you're thinking of questions now because I'm only finished. There's a whole range of language that Westerners use for Indigenous peoples in Canada and the US and the worldwide, around the world, that they don't use for themselves. Can we do a really quick exercise? Can the non-Indigenous people in the room who identify as Australian hold their hand up? Yep. Can you leave your hand up, thank you, if you have some mixed heritage, English, Irish, Chinese, Japanese? So nearly 100% of the 80% of the room, thank you. Would it be fair to say then that you all have one identity, that of Australian, and you have mixed heritage? Well, so do we.
Mm.
I have one identity, and obviously my wonderful late father was Austrian, but my entire socialisation process throughout life and living in Australia was as an Aboriginal girl, well, an Abbo, Born Coon, Chocolate Drop and Cocoa Pop when I was at school. But we have one identity with many heritages, which we all embrace and are proud of. But the language, I never hear white Australians say I'm half caste or I'm part Aboriginal because my grandparents were born in Scotland. Mm. 53 or 56% of Australians have at least one parent born overseas. Westerners talk about becoming cosmopolitan and multicultural and having development. We're told we're watering down our bloodlines, we're straddling two worlds, we're losing our culture, we're becoming urbanised. You know, we're told you're half-quartered. And don't kid yourself that language doesn't still exist, because it does. Mm. And Queensland's very bad. I say that from New South Wales. But yes. So there's a whole... Language matters and leadership matters, and that's what happened. There was a shift in language, and which then shifts the psyche of a nation. So we go from Paul Keating's empowering speech. We had Kevin Rudd's very empowering speech for... the apology. And we have a whole new language now. At the age of 41 or however old I was, for the first time in my life, I read in the newspaper that I'm a light-skinned Aborigine, that I'm a white Aborigine. I was always the brown kid at school. And now I'll be interested to see in the next version of the Macquarie Dictionary comes out whether or not we joke about it, but it's used so much now in all the debate outside of our circles about who we are, that light-skinned white Aboriginal, political Aboriginal. I might be surprised if that appears in the dictionary.
Well, I'm a half caste with a chip on my shoulder, but I say, don't worry, I'm working on the shoulder pads. Are there any questions?
Hello. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Davey Thompson, and my grandfather is Bidjara and Inungai Mob from Central West Queensland, and my grandmother's people are Waka Waka Gubbi Gubbi, they're my father's parents, and my mum's from the really, really big Miglu tribe. I have to ask, I lived out in Barcaldine for a long time, which is Central West Queensland, and for a long time I wasn't really exposed to all this black politics. It wasn't until really I came to the city that it really, really, really showed. And... you know, I'm not really a bush black. I just really need to ask a panel of experts, I guess. My Aboriginality in recent years has been questioned by both black and white. And I just really need to know what is harder for you guys to deal with. The black fellas questioning your Aboriginality or the white fellas?
For me, the deepest insult that an Aboriginal person can do to another Aboriginal person is to question it, And there's a whole lot of names that I'm not going to mention here that are used. And we talk about lateral violence, and I think that that's a real, real issue. Mm. I have to say, in my experience, my identity has been most problematic for non-Indigenous people, though.
Mm.
Yeah. They've been most troubled by my claim to my Aboriginality. I think it's harder in our community when we do cop it, because it rips at our soul that our own community would do that to us, knowing how... powerfully oppressive that has been for our people throughout our history. But my skin colour has been less problematic for my own community than it has for the wider community.
Yeah.
So I get... people are... you know, I'm sort of... my ethnicity is a bit ambiguous. So taxi drivers or hairdressers or strangers will say, so, you know, where are you from? And when I say, I sort of, sometimes I play with them and say Australia and just keep saying that. But when I say Aboriginal, there's this whole discussion about how I possibly couldn't possibly be Aboriginal.
Which is so beautiful for an Aboriginal.
Yeah, they really
and articulate so nicely.
So they know that I'm different, but they can't accept that I'm Aboriginal.
Yes. But one of the big things is, of course, if we were to go around the room and ask the blackfellas in this room, one of the things that does help us when we're discussing, we're not discussing colour because that's we're colourblind. We're discussing kinship. We know a lot of other people's families, and so we immediately know. Okay, Wiradjuri, my goodness. I know immediately what your country like Paul loves out there on the flat plains.
He's so jealous. Don't be
not
so jealous.
Not bunge along with that gorgeous rainforest. But it gives us that sense too that we know where your country is or we can feel
it's like
who you are.
It's like an Aboriginal passport.
Yeah. Is there any more questions?
No, hi, I'm Shane. Yeah, a number of years ago I was... working on an Aboriginal community in Northern Territory. And one of the maintenance guys there, Anglo, white Australian guy, he was, I'm a little sketchy on the details, so it was a while ago, but he was actually invited to some kind of initiation ceremony with the Indigenous community. And, yeah, I just wondered how that sort of fits into this debate where obviously he didn't have the Aboriginal heritage, but I guess to be invited to an initiation ceremony, he must have gained some sort of level in the community.
I know the right person who's actually sitting in the audience, and if you wouldn't mind, brother, someone who spent a lot of time in some communities where those sorts of ceremonies occur. John, would you mind just answering that whole thing about kinship and adoption into the community for this gentleman?
Many people are invited to either... There's two things. You can actually be invited to witness things. To take part in something is something else. And to take part in something means you have a commitment and a responsibility then to engage with that community and that family. Most of the people I know who go and witness things, many people do, and that's a privilege. It's a very, not a privilege, it's a very important thing to happen, and it's very strongly enlightening and revelatory to see those things. To actually take part means a commitment. And I've never seen the people who sometimes take part in a very peripheral way actually really bond to be responsible. Like, I can't see any of the men that I saw take part in a peripheral way. They're not going to give their daughters in marriage to somebody else. I can see that. It's a nice gesture on the part of the people there. It doesn't say you're Aboriginal. It fits you into a system. Everything has to fit into a system, into a social system. And that social system is actually part of a world view system, rather than just being about whether I'm related to you or me or whatever I'm actually fit into. It's a part of a mnemonic device and system that allows you to think about the world in a different way. It doesn't make you Aboriginal, though. It just means that you're fitted into that world. Just remember that Indonesian people were coming here well before Captain Cook, hundreds of years before Captain Cook. And they were incorporated into the Aboriginal world in Australia, but that didn't make them Aboriginal.
Mightn't work if they went out to La Perouse. I don't know much about that, but it also it's relevant for that particular place. So it'd be pointless going to Wagga and say, well, I've done ceremony in Santa Teresa or Mirudjulu.
We have another question. Thank you.
My name's Claire, and I'm just after some advice from the panel, really. I'm a non-Indigenous person, and I'm raising two beautiful Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. And I'm a sook, so I'll try not to cry. And their dad lives in Cairns, so they're separated from their family. And I'm just after some advice. Sorry, I am a sook. About how I can raise them to be strong black children and strong in their identities.
Do they have contact with their family back in Cairns?
Yeah, they do.
There's a big Torres Strait Islander and Aboriginal community in Brisbane, and particularly a lot of our old people are incredibly generous, not only with their time but their knowledge. And there's lots of organisations, you know, across the region. And I would suggest maybe contacting one of those organisations as well, so they have contact with other community members. Are they young children?
Yeah, they're 4 and 6.
Mm. Oh.
I think it's as Chelsea was saying, identity is really about connection and and not commitment necessarily, because it's about action within community. So it's just really about participation and being part of and belonging. Like, to me, community is about a belonging, whatever the community's architects or writers or whatever. So I think it's really, you know, about engaging with the
community. It's hard for them when they don't have that agency because they're so young and it's dependent on
babies,
me.
Yeah.
And you love them, very clearly love them.
Oh, I love them to death. And I've got connection with the community in Cairns too, but I'm not a Brisbane person and I don't have connection down here, and I'm just endlessly worried about what that's going to mean for their identity and for them when they're growing up. And I try my absolute best, but it's just not the same, I guess.
But I think you're well on the way. Like, I can't advise you as a mother, but as a child, when I was growing up in Brisbane, I do remember my mother being very isolated with our small family, but she made sure we went home, and that was enough to keep the gate open. So every time I go home to the mission, we'd fight, I'd come back, and this kept happening. This, like, year in, year out. By the time 15, boys, well, we're kind of good mates now, and then now we're inseparable. So it's contact. Yeah. But I mean, I think if the kids have a mother who is aware of this matter, like, they're incredibly lucky kids.
So. Yeah. And can I just say, as an Indigenous mum, I share your same fear because of... Well, you know, we are a minority, and how do I raise my kids with a strong sense of identity and all that kind of stuff. We lived in Brisbane. My family are in North Queensland and down Tweed Heads, so we were the one family in our family that were on our own in a, you know, predominantly white neighbourhood. It was my white mother that took us to NAIDOC Week every year as kids, you know. So you have a role to play, and it's a journey of exploring different options and ways to engage, and anything you do is something. And encouraging our children to think critically about what they're hearing about themselves and empowering them to be strong and who they are and be authentic to their own story, I think is really important.
We've got room for two more questions. This gentleman here and then one over there, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
Yama, my name is Bo Spiron. My father is from northern New South Wales,
a small town
called Moree, from the mission there. My mother, her name is Nerida Skewthock, from Mount Garuga on a reserve. She was born... What I wanted to ask is, what is a middle-class Aboriginal, and with that name tag, will that create segregation within our own communities, just like half-caste, full-blood, and quarter-caste?
Good question.
Can I just say, I really loathe the term middle-class Aboriginal. There was a study, I think, done in the 90s by the Centre for Aboriginal Economic Policy Research, and they looked at... Aboriginal income and versus the mainstream. And we genuinely know that the higher income you get, the better outcomes you have in a whole range of indicators in terms of education and housing and all this kind of stuff and health. But for Indigenous people, there wasn't the same shift upwards with income. So to just think about Aboriginal people solely in terms of fortnightly wage actually doesn't do justice to the experience of being an Indigenous person. And so even if you may be middle class or may have a job and have a regular wage coming in, you're still supporting your family, you're still taking people into your home, you don't stop being Aboriginal just because you're in a higher income bracket. And the statistics show us that Aboriginal people don't see the same benefits with the increase in income that the general population do, and that tells us a story about the experience of Aboriginal people.
It certainly does. They obviously don't work in the arts.
They're not writers who earn $11,000 a year.
Yeah, that's right.
No, the whole bourgeois black thing, love that term. Everybody that I know that's gone through university and wherever they're working in government, or they're not writers or anyone like in our field, but they're all actually responsible for looking after their family, and you're there. So they may be earning an income, but it's actually going across an entire family. Mm. And they're also the ones that are chairing boards and then are sitting in organisations, and, you know, they may be working high rank policy or whatever they're doing, but they're also doing a whole lot of other things. And so I think when we see our people in despair, we feel in it our heart. When we see our people doing well, we put them down. I just go, I don't get that.
The tall poppy syndrome in the Aboriginal communities is very alive and well, and it is, that is another discussion, and it is something we should really consider. We've got room for one more question.
Very quickly, greetings from the Torres Strait. My name's Kane Atwano. I'm a Miriam man from the Dawareb tribe. Quickly, can I just say I work with young people. I work with a whole range of young people in schools. We are now getting a whole generation of young people, like Sister said here with your children. We are getting children who, through family, are identifying, oh, we've got some Aboriginal, and they're saying, yep, when there's time for leadership camps, they want to be part of it. And I work with kids who come in with this distorted view of the world in terms of who they are. We are getting, and this is across the country, we are getting young people now who, I grew up in the 70s and 60s, was a fear generation. Blackfellas were living in fear. My parents lived in fear. We were frightened of government. Government come and take us. Now, these kids are being told, hey, you know, got a prime minister saying sorry. So we're now empowering these young people. So how do we cope with this new generational change? It's no good talking about, you know, now. We've got to look for the next 20, 50 years and where we're going as a community and a culture.
Thank you. I've been given the wrap-up. Was there one last question over here? Okay, can we just do this one last? There you go, sis.
Oh, my name's Kayla Tyson. I'm a Maroonie woman of the Gurang Nation, and I have ties to the Noongar people of the Quandamooka region. Speaking on what Kainat said, there is a new generation, and mine's not a question but more of a challenge to everyone. The young Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people in the room, not even young, because I know that, you know, not everybody knows where they came from, whether you're young, old or whatever. But we're at a time, in a time where we can get on the internet in 1 second and learn a lot of things. It may not always be right what's written up on there, especially on Wikipedia, but there's no excuse for us. There's no excuse for us not to know things. Like, there's no excuse for us to be ignorant. We have these events that are on, and yeah, it's not going to give us all the answers that we need, but it's triggering questions in our mind where we can then go and find the answers for that. And my challenge to our people is that it's our time to empower ourselves. Don't stand there and wait for the government to put our language and our education into the schools. Find it yourself and then teach someone else. And for the non-Aboriginal people in the room, it's just about breaking down that stereotype. Like they were saying, like, can all my girls stand up, please, in this line? Just stand up for 1 second, Becky. Stand up.
They're beautiful girls.
Look at my girls.
Yeah.
We all work, we're all beautiful, and we're all Aboriginal. We all look different. Mm. And yes, we might go out and drink and dance and party and everything on the weekend, just like your kids do. Mm. We're no different. So just think about that.
Wow.
On that wonderful, spirited note, thank you for the respect, darling. Thank you. Our future indeed is bright. We do know who we are. We all live on an incredibly ancient land. But the beauty you folks have in this room, we have knowledge keepers who come from the oldest living adapting race on the entire planet. No one else has got it. Thank you. Thank you to our panel.